I'm Greg Johnson. Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. My guest today is Chris Robertson. He is the author of a book called In Defense of Hatred, and he also spoke on this topic at last month's Northwest Forum. So, Chris, welcome to the show.
Pleased to be with you.
So, tell us a little bit about yourself, how old you are, where you're from, how you came to be involved in circles like ours, and how you came to write your book.
Well, I am 26. I was raised in the sunny suburbs of Sammamish, which is a nice liberal neighborhood in western Washington. And I didn't go to college originally. I went to the military first. And by the time I got to college, I had sort of my sights set as far as what sort of intellectual experience I wanted to have. And shockingly, college didn't provide that. College didn't seem particularly interested in intellectual exploration at all. I had been sort of introduced to the joys of debate and heavy conversations by Christopher Hitchens, a man I still respect tremendously, despite not really agreeing with him about anything else, except maybe free speech. And between that, religion, I got introduced to Jonathan Haidt and realized that maybe Republicans aren't idiots that are wrong about everything. And from there, it was a hop, skip, and a jump to, oh, liberals are actually wrong about everything. And I eventually got fired from my job at the school paper in Bellevue for going a little bit too far into a case of false flag hate speech at the school's LGBTQ Resource Center. So rather than accepting the 4-year degree path I'd been planning on going on, I sort of dismissed all college as evil and jumped to truck driving. And between that, carpentry, and pest control, I'm a married guy living in, about 20 miles southeast of Seattle, so still Western Washington. And I think I got turned on to the idea that hatred might not be such a bad thing, based on a really bad argument that I was seeing pop up, really, especially in the aftermath of the Bataclan massacre in Paris, how people were saying we shouldn't give in to hatred. And the more I thought about it and the more I delved into it, it just really seemed like a bad argument, is essentially what it came down to. And the more I looked into it and the more I read my Nietzsche and the other psychologists and fleshed out where it would go if you eliminated hatred from the table of possibilities, it really seemed to be a variation of what Nietzsche would have called anti-life, sort of a degenerate tendency that would preclude any value at all, at least that you could defend when push came to shove between competing values.
So you mentioned Nietzsche, you mentioned Hitchens. Who are some of your other intellectual influences and inspirations?
Oh, man. the overarching one is probably Aristotle, but I would have to say that the most shocking one for me, who basically single-handedly deconverted me from the religion of libertarianism, was Matthew Crawford. He provided a really different, and it struck me as an older conception of what a person is that I had never, I don't know if the right phrase is, never understood or been able to articulate before. That he sort of introduced in his book Shop Class of Soulcraft and then really fleshed out in The World Beyond Your Head, particularly as it pertains to the ethics that sort of lie beneath a libertarian society and what that allows people to do in terms of their claims to your attention, because we're basically the products of what we pay attention to. And I won't deliver the whole book here, but it was a very, very compelling argument, and it's one that I find creeping into a lot of my ideas. It shows up a little bit in Defense of Hatred. I think the third chapter is not quite plagiarized, but very, very heavily influenced by that book.
So were you studying philosophy? Because obviously you seem to be very much interested in it.
It depends on how you define study.
In college, yeah.
I took an introduction to philosophy course essentially in high school, and I took a contemporary moral problems class in college. But most of my study of philosophy was a combination of reading and audiobooks while I was truck driving and arguing with friends in a variety of locations and venues. Most of the people that I admire and who strike me as being intellectually respectable either did not go to college or seem to have acquired their unique worldview in spite of or in opposition to what they were taught in college. And so Hitchens isn't the best example of that, but Crawford is an excellent one, because here is a guy who got his PhD in the, I believe it was the history of political thought or something to that effect. He ended up getting a job at a think tank and quitting that soul-crushing, dishonest, mindless job of churning out papers, defending positions he didn't really care about, to become a motorcycle technician, which for him was much more cognitively challenging. And it's a sort of perspective that you very often – it's not that you can't see it at college. It's that it won't even be entertained due in part to the the incentives and why everyone's there. They're there to get their sheet of paper and not to explore ideas.
Yeah, that's very true. You know, I got a PhD myself in philosophy. And yet, if I were starting over today, if I were 18 years old today, knowing what I know now and seeing how the higher education system has declined so terribly, I don't think I would go to college. I would try a different route. So I cannot really blame you. And there are a lot of men, white men, who are opting out of the college path and looking for other ways to educate themselves. And one of the things that Countercurrents is a kind of right-wing online university for people who want to get a different perspective that's not politically correct, and really who just want any kind of introduction at all to some topics, because you can't even get some of these thinkers and issues that we discuss at all anymore, not even in a kind of slanted, politically correct way. So Let's talk a bit about your In Defense of Hatred book. I'd really like to begin by making some distinctions. I think making distinctions really is very important to philosophy, you know, getting your basic terms down. And I appreciate how careful you are about that. So,
thank you.
What is the difference between, say, hating somebody or something and being angry at it?
Anger, as I understand it, and as I sort of define it in the book for the purpose of the argument, is anger is essentially an appeal to a higher authority that you both you and the person that you are angry at share. It's a moral feeling, feeling of moral outrage, and there's some constrained element in terms of time. It's like, this is, if you're angry at someone, it's something that can be healed. It's not an essential, you're not angry at some essential quality of their character, but something that they did. And the feeling is, it's more like surprise that they, I don't want to get too descriptive like that, but basically it tends not to prepare your body and your mind for intense violence and traumatic violence in the way that hatred would. I think the way I framed it in the book is it's the sort of emotion that might prepare you to punch someone in the face, but it wouldn't prepare you to draw a knife up from their stomach or to hit them in the head with an axe.
So what's the difference? So anger for you has some kind of aspect of moral outrage that So what's the difference between anger and, say, just being annoyed with somebody? Because when I think of things that make me angry, I don't necessarily think of things that are really morally outrageous so much as things that are just dumb or inconsiderate, you know, the upstairs neighbor clomping around and moving furniture at 3 a.m. or things like that. I mean, that's sort of what makes me angry normally. It's not so much moral indignation generally. It's just being treated in an inconsiderate way or seeing things that don't even affect me, but things that shouldn't be, like flagrant waste or stuff like that, a badly built building, something that lacks intelligence, whatever.
Oh, yeah. Well, if you're a good libertarian, you would recognize all of these things as acts of aggression upon your sensitivities and shoot them. But that aside, I think it's mostly a difference of scale. And it's hard to – I was watching a video the other day differentiating between being afraid and being creeped out. And the point was that being creepy – being creeped out comes from a feeling of ambiguity between being unable to tell whether you should be afraid or if it's something normal. The author of the video talked about the uncanny valley where something has some signals of friend and some signals of foe, and we're not sure how to react. And I think that a lot of the times that we are annoyed by something, we're sensing a violation of some moral expectation about this is how a society is supposed to function, but it's not severe enough to make a big deal about, and we would probably be the ones making things worse if we did make a big deal about it, but we're still bothered that it's happening. So we just go about and complain to our buddy over drinks on Friday about, oh, this dumbass was, you know, doesn't know how to use a blinker in traffic and is going to get someone killed, blah, blah, blah. But in reality, failing to conform to these sorts of norms and shared expectations of society, is a kind of failure to that society if we have any right to expect anything of each other. So I think the difference between anger and annoyance has to do with whether we think someone's just stupid or if they're flagrantly disregarding the norms, particularly at our own expense.
Yeah, there is definitely a normative dimension to everything is connected with anger and annoyance. Because, you know, if it's something that's just as annoying as a loud noise or something like that, it's still taxing to your nervous system. It's outside the normal range of what's pleasant. Yeah. So there are norms involved here.
If you don't mind me interrupting, this is something actually that Crawford talked about. He describes going through airports and all of these spaces have advertisements and sounds being piped in vying for your attention. And the higher class sections of the airport, you can actually pay to have access to silence where your senses aren't being assaulted. And he has a description in there of feeling the stress lines fade in your face and feeling being able to let down your guard, because these advertisements and news companies and all of these companies vying for your attention use fast movements and sounds in order to, I forget the exact psychological name for the response that you generate, but there's basically no way to stop it if you're a human being. You naturally respond to potential threat stimuli by turning to look at it. And always having your head on a swivel is exhausting. Having to always process this information is tiring, and it doesn't allow you to focus on the things that are actually important in your own life. In some sense, it's an assault on your very identity, but it's so dispersed and the responsibility is so spread out that it's hard to pinpoint who's responsible for it. You feel like you're in Kafka's trial. trying to get down to the bottom of who's responsible. Where does the buck stop? The buck never does appear to stop for most people.
You know, Schopenhauer has a wonderful essay on noise, and he talks about how, especially for intelligent people for whom mental focus is an important part of their lives, noise is torture. And when you're around less intelligent people, you tend to find that they have a greater tolerance for noise, and they're willing to subject other people to sort of flagrant noise all the time. I remember this one family that my parents knew when I was growing up, and you'd go over to the house and you could hear the television blasting all the way out to the street. And you know, you'd get inside and the television would be blasting, and then they'd be yelling at one another to, you know, speak over the television. The kids would be screaming, the dog would be barking. It was intolerable. It was like, can we just de-escalate this a bit? And Schopenhauer has these beautiful metaphors where he talks about, or I guess they're analogies, really. He basically says that what noise does to concentration is it basically destroys its, you know, all value of mental concentration by breaking it up, in the same way that a large diamond is priceless, but if you smash it into dust, it's worthless. And it's the same with your ability to concentrate. If it's whole, it's priceless, and if it's shattered into a million bits by noise, it's worthless. And, you know, the constant din of something like an airport, where they're trying to constantly solicit your attention. It's like going through some, you know, Oriental bazaar, and there all these people are, you know, touting their wares and trying to get your attention. It is pretty exhausting, definitely.
Oh, I was just going to add, in my adventures of truck driving, I remember driving through Las Vegas a number of times. And there you have basically an entire city designed to part you from your money, and but perhaps more importantly also from your attention. It's just nothing but flashing lights and tall towers and things to look at. There's fighter jets zooming overhead and race cars ripping around a track.
There are free drinks and showgirls and all, you know, and all these things in the casinos. And of course, one of the reasons why they do that is to totally rattle the nerves and concentration of anybody who might be actually a card counter, or somebody who can beat the house, right? If somebody starts doing really well at one of these games, they'll say, have a free martini on the house. And some girl in a slinky dress will bring you a free martini. Anything really to break your concentration and just get you back to the losing that is their industry. Your loss is their gain, right? Let's talk about disgust, because I'm feeling disgust now when I think of Las Vegas. I mean, what's the difference between, say, being angry with somebody, being annoyed with somebody, and being disgusted with somebody or something?
Well, it's very sophisticated of you to feel disgust towards Las Vegas. I think most people feel just a vague sense of that's not my place. That was sort of how I felt when I was going through it. As I understood disgust, and this is drawn in part from David Pizarro's work. I believe I'm remembering his name correctly. Disgust is sort of the response that we have to inanimate objects that are, well, not necessarily inanimate, but things that could be harmful to us that aren't intelligent, that aren't conscious. You know, things that are possibly diseased or poisonous, things that are unhealthy and might make us unhealthy by connection to it. And disgust is a very interesting reaction, because the things that we are disgusted by can transfer very easily through contact. For example, if we're disgusted by a person that appears to be very dangerously diseased, And then we see someone else who's totally healthy, but the healthy person touches the diseased person. We might then become very disgusted by the healthy person. I work in pest control. I see maggot-ridden corpses of rats and mice pretty much every day. So mine might be a little dulled, but disgust is different from hatred. It's different from anger, first of all, in that there's no moral component. It's just pure survival, and there's no need, like fear, there's no need to display anything in disgust. You just need to get yourself, particularly your mouth and your nose, away from the thing that is potentially dangerous. Whereas with something like hatred, you have to be more conscious, and your mind sort of naturally prepares you for dealing with a conscious entity rather than something like, you know, dog feces.
Yeah, it is interesting, though. One can learn to feel disgust, though, I think, with things that are not just gross.
Well, like Las Vegas, right?
Like Las Vegas, yeah.
I mean,
it's a matter of taste.
You can call it gross.
It's a matter of taste, yeah.
It's sort of abstract to call Las Vegas gross.
Right.
You can understand the corrosive effect that a city like that can have on a person, but it's not something that we get quite as intuitively, though that reaction can be developed if you're exposed to its effects long enough. And you can see the sorts of things that does to someone, say, oh, I know what this does. It's no better than, you know, eating something, you know, a maggot-ridden rat corpse for your health. It might even be worse.
Yeah. It's like a lot of Hollywood type stuff. I see what that leads to. And so it's like candy coated rat poison or something like that. You look past the surface of these things and you just feel the horror because you have some understanding of the causality of what's going on. So, some things can seem sweet and tasty and attractive and alluring, but if you know the bad consequences of them, your tastes sort of change, I think, so that you have a learned disgust response to certain things. I mean, we're all disgusted by gross smells. I mean, when I think of disgust, I think of primarily things that smell. That look horrible and that smell. When you smell a disgusting thing, your face, you grimaces, you don't want to touch it. You don't want to taste it. You don't want to get any closer to it than sight and smell generally. And, the very thought of like getting it close to your mouth will actually make you physically want to retch. Maybe we're going too far down this path. I don't know. I
might be mixing my TED Talks, but there was a one of the guys talking about disgust described the difficulty of poisoning people back in the old days because our bodies are so attuned at detecting things through smell that could be harmful to us that a truly talented poisoner was quite expensive. And quite valuable to if you had the money to pay them.
Right, because people would smell something is off.
Yes, and I think one of the high points of David Pizarro's talk on disgust was showing the video of him wafting a vial of, I can't remember what it was, it might have been ammonia or something, underneath Richard Dawkins' nose and getting him to almost vomit three times in a row.
That's interesting. Yeah, but, you know, one of the things that people try and do with us, with people on the right, the people who want to stigmatize us and demonize us, is they actually will make a great show of treating us like we're just disgusting. Like, and disgust literally means it's distasteful, right? Mm-hmm. It's a judgment of taste.
Yeah.
It's an aesthetic judgment, a judgment of taste. Something is disgusting as opposed to salubrious or attractive, or something you'd want to eat, something gustatory. I don't know if that's even a word. That's not the correct use of it. But the people who want to treat, say, racists and haters as thought criminals, and stigmatize us, will make a great show of just of treating us like we're physically disgusting. Your ideas are disgusting. It just makes me sick to hear these sorts of things, that kind of talk. And I don't know if that's real or fake, honestly.
I think that's why people like you and like Richard Spencer are so damaging to their narrative when you talk in a very reasonable and straightforward fashion. Whenever I'm talking to people, well, not whenever, but very frequently, I've found myself pointing people to your conversation with the roaming millennial, mm-hmm. Which is very enjoyable and funny to listen to, because it so violates the stereotype that, and I suppose to answer your question, I think it's put on. I think they're trying to will the association into existence through repetition, mm-hmm. and that can work to some degree. Mm-hmm. If people don't have exposure to people like you, who will speak clearly and logically about subjects deemed taboo, mm-hmm. and they're like, oh, that seems quite reasonable, but they've have this pre-built association of right, and not even racist views necessarily, right-wing views generally. It always amused me. It has amused me, I should say, the last year, where people have said, oh, Trump's such a virulent bigot. Hillary Clinton getting up and saying, I've worked with people across the aisle for years, and we've had our disagreements, but, they were never unfit for office. And I remember listening to that speech and thinking, what are you talking about? I've watched my dad watch MSNBC for 10 years. And I've known that Republicans have been racist for longer than that. There's nothing different in the narrative here.
Well, she was really trying to appeal to Republicans, honestly, with that kind of rhetoric.
Oh, of course.
And of course, I remember she talked about Bob Dole. And we need that kind of leadership again. And I thought, yeah, you'd love to be running against Bob Dole. Why? Because he was a loser. He lost.
That's our friend Vox Day's territory right there on mm-hmm. the conservative issue. People mm-hmm. trying to appeal to the opposite side to gain favor among the mass. I mean, that was, to quote my left-wing hero's idea, Christopher Hitchens' big criticism of the Clinton family was essentially that they were cucking to the right, that they were selling out their values for basically political victory. Now, that might be beneficial to our cause and the right generally, in that at least we're getting some of the things we want, but there's something just unappealing about that. And as much as I dislike Obama and oppose pretty much everything about what he wanted to do with the country, I at least appreciate that he seemed to, at some level, believe in the things he was advocating for. You feel like you're dealing with something, at least with a little bit of rigidity to it, whereas with the Clintons, it was just, there's nothing there. And that's, I think, the case with a lot of these cuckservatives who would be willing recipients of Hillary's appeal to the middle.
Right. There's nothing I despise more than people who are unprincipled. Even people who have wrong principles, I think, are more admirable than people who have no principles.
Absolutely.
And even,
because you can't grow without principles. You can't see that your principles are wrong if you don't stick to them.
Right. And, even people who are nominally on my side but have no principles are less admirable to me than somebody with principles who's on the other side. And the reason for that is ultimately that if they don't have principles, if they don't really, I mean, what's a man who has no principles? Well, he's not anchored in what he thinks is true and good.
He's a jellyfish.
Yeah, he goes with all kinds of different ocean currents, right? And therefore, in the long run, you can't really rely on these people. You can't really trust them to be brave, because, well, they're jellyfish. What are they going to be brave for? What are they going to take risks for, right? So, yeah, even somebody who's unprincipled but on my side nominally strikes me as a really a dubious object of any kind of esteem, and they're not going to be on my side forever, especially if the going gets tough. And that's when you really need to have people on your side. You don't evaluate people based on how they behave when they're not under any pressure. You evaluate them on how they behave when they're under pressure. That's when you see courage. And I think the big thing about unprincipled people that really bothers me at heart is that they're cowardly people. And
Absolutely.
Aristotle's Ethics, I think, is one of the three great books in ethics, along with Plato's Republic and also the Theory of Moral Sentiments by Adam Smith.
Yes, that's an underrated book.
Yeah, I think it's a tremendous work. It's really a work of classical ethics, I think. He's very much a Stoic thinker there. But anyway, Aristotle, when he talks about the virtues, what are the first two virtues he discusses in the Ethics? It's courage and temperance. And what are courage and temperance for? Well, they're for dealing with pain and pleasure, which are the two biggest problems for forming a stable personality, right? If you cannot resist pleasure or resist fear when they get in the way of doing the right thing, then you will not do the right thing. And really, there is a strong sense in which all the virtues depend on courage, because you can't be honest if you're not courageous enough to speak the truth when somebody is giving you signals or pressure to lie, right? So none of your virtues are any good at all if you don't have the courage to stand up to the things that oppose them.
Absolutely. And it's funny you bring up fear. I think that a fair bit of the modern opposition to hatred, which is sort of a disguised fear of loving, is just caving into fear. Because if you really, truly love something, that the seriousness of the love is conveyed in what you are willing to sacrifice and what you are willing to risk to defend and protect and to retain the thing that you love.
Right. If you love something, you're vulnerable. You have given a hostage to fortune. And I think a
Exactly.
lot of people are not willing to own up to the fact that they love anything just because it makes them so vulnerable. But once you own up to it and own up to your vulnerability, then you've got to think, wow, what am I going to have to do? What will I have to be willing to do to save this? What will happen to me if I lose it? And so forth.
Right. Well, and there's also some semantic alchemy that goes on where loving something can be translated as having a preference for something, which can become a bias for something. And if you act out your bias, then you're acting out of hatred. And we all know that hatred is just pure evil. Nothing good comes from hatred.
Yeah, let's talk a bit about that. I really think that one of the things that hamstrings our culture is this silly, superstitious fear of hatred. Whenever I hear this, I always make fun of it by quoting Obi-Wan Kenobi, "Don't give in to hate, Luke." That leads to the dark side. And it's like, oh, come on, please. Do we have to run our societies today by mumbo jumbo from Star Wars films? And of course, you don't just find it in Star Wars, you find it in Martin Luther King. You can't drive out darkness with darkness. Well, why not?
You're quoting my opening chapter
I
there.
know, I know. Well, I read your
Yes,
book.
It is silly, and it's just a string of platitudes. And one of the formative cases in my education in school, because I spent a lot of my time at the college paper I worked at, figuring out and defending the freedom of speech of students that was under a shocking degree of danger and attack by the administration and by certain members of the faculty in classrooms and elsewhere. And one of the cases that stuck out to me was the 1946 ruling given by Justice Robert Jackson saying, you know, if we don't want our, you know, Constitution to become mere platitudes to these people, then we really ought to uphold these things and teach them by example to these students that we expect to be the future generation of citizens in this country. Therefore, the First Amendment has to be defended for students, especially, and not just as a side thing or maybe put aside for the sake of educational purposes. This is education and what it means to be an American. And I think there's something, just going back to what we were talking about before about annoyance, there's something incredibly irritating when people bring platitudes to the debate table as though they have some argument. They reference some Star Wars quote or whatever without ever thinking through the implications of getting rid of something as powerful and important as hatred. Hatred is simply what we feel when either ourselves or something that we love tremendously is under existential threat by something else whose essential nature is opposed to its existence. I think of I was listening to a YouTuber named Davis Arini, who's sort of a weird character, but brings up some interesting points every now and then again. At about the time that the Bataclan massacre happened, and he had brought up the play Titus Andronicus, which was one I hadn't read at the time. And here you have Tamora, the queen of the Goths, whose her whole life purpose after the death of her son is vengeance. And there's no way to reconcile her existence with the continued existence of Titus Andronicus and his family. It's like, you have to get rid of this person. And failing to do that is to fail in your love for your own family and for yourself. So taking hatred off the table as an option is tantamount to taking any kind of meaningful love off the table. And one of the what I hope will be a persuasive argument in this is that if you take off the power of your love, if you reduce that to essentially nothing, then you actually become less lovable yourself, especially if you're a male, because society looks to you for value that you can provide. And if your adoration and love means nothing, well, then you can just go away. No one needs you. No one wants you. No one has time for you. If you can't provide anything, you become pathetic. And no one likes things that are pathetic. I think it was Osama bin Laden that said, everyone prefers the strong horse to the weak horse, ceteris paribus.
Yeah, so let's talk about some things that are related, especially to Titus Andronicus and to hatred in general. Concepts like resentment, bitterness, and spite. Those are, I think, very much connected with hatred, especially hatred that becomes a career, right? It becomes a long-term thing. You know, there are two things that I can say now that I'm getting older. I'm starting to have these dad-type talks, you know, to young whippersnappers. It's like, as you get older, you discover that there are more and more things that you build up in your life that you feel bitter about. And the other thing is that the longer you live, the more chance you're going to find that there are people out there who are going to make a career of hating you. And It's kind of a burden. It's kind of a burden to have. And it's also something you want to avoid falling into yourself. And yet, it's very, very easy to fall into this. I think this is one of the reasons why forgiveness is actually, although it doesn't make any metaphysical sense, because if you forgive somebody who wrongs you, they still have wronged you. It doesn't change the past. But what it does do is it helps you stop resenting it, if it works, right?
Yes.
So how are hatred, resentment, and bitterness related?
I think of bitterness as a kind of lower tier synonym for resentment. Spite being sort of the passive aggressive active form of spite of resentment. Resentment is a dangerous one, and I like to separate that from hatred. I was out working actually, and I had stopped at a McDonald's, which was probably a bad choice. But I ran into a Catholic priest in there, and I offered to pay for his lunch if he would answer some questions. He of course turned down the money, but said, certainly, you know, ask away. And I was asking him about is hatred ever justified in Catholicism? And he said, well, no, it really is never justified, because whenever we're hating something, we are hating some weakness in ourselves that someone else is bringing out. And I actually agreed with him. I liked that framing of it, with the exception of the terminology he was applying to it, because I think he had just described the phenomenon of resentment perfectly, but he called it hatred. And the danger is that it provides no path towards improvement or overcoming of your own weaknesses. And it's an easy out for self-improvement if you let yourself do it too much. And there's actually a danger in excessive hatred as well that I tried to outline in the book as well. And I think it has to do with the ratio of love to hatred. If you find yourself hating things and resenting things more than you actually spend loving the things that are worth valuing and raising up and admiring, then you've probably got your priorities out of line, and it's probably not an emotionally sustainable path. I have a family member actually who's a very strong Democrat, not a progressive in the proper sense, but you know, loves Rachel Maddow, and I remember checking in with them because I had unfriended them on Facebook. I remember checking in with them, and they had posted, I kid you not, 30 or so posts within a 6-day period. And I think 29 out of those 30 posts were about Trump and how terrible he was and how this country is all going to hell. And I was, my mind wasn't even on politics at that point. I was like, for your own health, you need to go out and camp or something. You need to get away from this news cycle because this is destroying you. And incidentally, that person was having heart issues at the time and weren't sleeping very well. They're sort of overweight. They're not taking very good care of themselves. And I'm sure that Trump wasn't very good for them, but it wasn't Trump's fault. It was their fault.
That is interesting, definitely. When I think of resentment, I think of something that, well, first of all, it's directed at something that you feel is an injustice or an indignity that is abiding and hasn't been, you know, you've gotten no justice.
Mm-hmm.
It's a feeling of being aggrieved. It's a feeling of being unjustly treated. It's a feeling of not getting any satisfaction.
It's and the it outcome just, of anger.
Yeah, and but it just goes on and on and on. It's like you can't get any satisfaction. You can't get any peace. Well, it can poison your whole life. And the poisoning of your life is bitterness. But for me, bitterness has the quality of a neurosis. You can tell that people are embittered when they are constantly, all this pent-up anger that has not been satisfied or expelled, right? That hasn't avenged itself on the proper object. All this pent-up anger comes screaming out of them when it gets triggered by something that reminds them.
They get trapped in their emotion.
Well, yeah, and they have these unrequited feelings of anger that they can't get any justice, right? And so they carry this around. And then somebody pops up on the scene who reminds them of their real enemy. And you see them engaged in just, they explode in anger against somebody who's a completely innocent person. Another way in which bitterness is terribly poisoning is that basically bitter people feel like, I'm suffering, so why shouldn't other people suffer?
Dangerous.
Yeah, I've been treated badly, so why should I care about treating other people correctly? Until the world acknowledges my pain, I am just going to be a shit and not treat people justly. I'm not going to go out of my way to help humanity if humanity isn't helping me, and on and on and on. And then it just it becomes a source of resentment and bitterness for other people. And with spite, I mean, the element of spite for me, you know, is connected with self-destruction. Cutting off your nose to spite your face. Spite is what happens when the bitterness and anger and resentment gets so bad that you're willing to harm yourself to hurt your enemies.
Did you see the news article of the lesbian feminist who carved a bunch of far-right symbols and stuff into her own body with a knife and called the police and claimed a hate crime?
No, but, you know, it doesn't surprise me.
It was one of the most, like, distilled examples of evil I think I've ever seen. Not in its scale, obviously, but just in the distilled emotion of spite and resentment and probably misplaced resentment. But I mean, that's sort of beside the point, I think, when you're dealing with spite.
Yeah, that's just awful. And of course, these people are seeking attention too, and they're seeking kudos. They're engaged in the equivalent of pious frauds, right?
Oh, absolutely.
They're testifying to the truth of their narrative, and the fact that they're telling lies doesn't bother them because they feel like it's a virtuous lie. It's a pious act of fraudulence.
Well, the act that I actually got fired for investigating at Bellevue College was the director of the LGBTQ Resource Center there. She had been creeping out actually gay and lesbian members of that center for a while, actually, who were leaving. And we were like, we don't like this straight girl who's leading this group anyways. But they had been seeing all sorts of weird stuff that she'd been reporting, and they didn't really trust her. And one day this script Fags and Homos appeared written on the calendar. It appeared to have been written overnight, the sort of non-vandalous hate crime that they wanted to prosecute as a felony, which was amusing because it had been written in erasable marker on a dry erase board. But, you know. And it turned out that the only two door codes that had been used overnight between the hours where people had left that area and not seen that, and the morning after where the faculty member came in and noticed it, had been the LGBTQ Resource Center director and her boyfriend. And that kind of misplaced spite and resentment and And this is where the importance of differentiating things, because everyone calls that hatred. And they're not wrong in the broad sense, but it's a particular kind of hatred that is so poisonous to both yourself and to basically everyone around you. It's hard for ordinary people to wrap their minds around that there are people like that out there. And honestly, I think that's one of the things that ties people up around the JQ. Once they start seeing evidence of it, they're like, no one could really hate us that much, that persistently for so long.
Right. And in ways that are not even good for themselves, things that are against their own self-interest. And that's really the thing, again, that I get back to with spite. And that's what makes anger, resentment and bitterness and spite so dangerous, because when they get to that pitch of spite, people aren't rational anymore in the sense that you can't appeal to their self-interest. They cannot be appealed to by rational self-interest. They will do things that will harm themselves, and therefore you can't count on them to be quote-unquote rational in the modern bourgeois sense of the word.
I would say that there's a place for anger. Resentment and spite are almost universally bad, though. At that point, you've lost, and you're better to move on, even if you think that you are in the right.
Yeah. I would agree. But the fact that these things exist really mean, I think, that the world of liberal utopia will never happen. It'll never happen because people are not rational in the bourgeois sense, and they're willing to die to avenge themselves on people, or stand-ins for people that they hate. And that phenomenon really causes the whole Star Trek utopia to tremble. You know, it's not going to happen. We're not going to live in a world without hate. We're not going to live in a world without borders. We're not going to live in a world without enemies, without police, without guns, without existential threats. Mm-hmm. Because people are just not going to be that sweetly rational. And when people like that appear on the scene, they might walk on two legs and they might be very careful at hiding their malice. But if you let down your guard, you'll lose everything, potentially.
Absolutely. And it also presumes that we'll get beyond the economics of desire. I mean, even if we can all eat and drink and be housed without competing with each other, we're at least competing for each other's attention. And even if every guy gets, a woman, do they all get that woman that everyone wants? No, they don't.
Yeah,
there's this competition in an escalating fashion that never stops. And by the way, I think we would all be quite despondent and sad if there wasn't a competition, if there wasn't some meaningful achievement that we could strive for that would separate us from other people. We're just not the sort of communist animals that liberals would like us to be.
Yeah. And if there is going to be scarcity in the world, especially in the economy of honor and respect, that's where fighting comes from. The classic Marxist and liberal idea, which is utterly false and childish, is that conflict comes because of scarcity of physical goods. When that's generally not the case, conflict will always exist because there are things that are more important than physical goods to people, and there are things connected with honor and recognition and respect. And
absolutely.
That is not going to disappear. We're not going to ever get enough of that. And one of the things that you learn when you grow up, and it's a really hard thing to learn, and the more narcissistic amongst us suffer the torments of the damned because they can't learn this, is that nobody will ever like you as much as you think you should be liked. Mm-hmm. And that differential between the expectations that you have for respect and what the world is willing to give you is always going to be a source of pain, a source of resentment, a source of bitterness, spite, and fighting. You know, and history begins in Hegel with the fight to the death over prestige, over honor. It doesn't have any, and if people are willing to die over honor, that means that the whole economy of physical desire is subordinate to something else.
Well, and the greater challenge to that is goes back to what you opened this conversation with, which is the value of courage. We are drawn to and love courage in other people. And if I track back in history all the people that I've most enjoyed, from Christopher Hitchens to Jack Donovan and everyone in between, it was the courage in the face of adversity that was so sort of universally attractive about these people. There's something magnetic about it. And if you eliminate that competition and that conflict, then to some degree, you're actually eliminating the very grounds for real, meaningful love between people, and a kind of loose and empty existence. As a social animal, that sounds like the worst kind of hell to me.
Yeah, it's a world where you can't really respect anybody.
Mm-hmm.
You might like everybody. Everyone might be glad handling and patting each other on the back and giving each other little back rubs in the office and little care bears and chocolate bunnies and all that kind of gooey stuff that women do around offices. But you can't really respect anybody in a world like that.
Once you get a taste for genuine respect and genuine love through adversity, then all of the superficial, niceties,
the Mylar kindness, balloon,
it feels so fake. It actually feels disgusting.
Yeah.
Me, it's like, get your icky superficial kindness away from me. I don't trust this. I don't like this. I feel like you're trying to get something out of me. Give me back my real friends who will talk shit about me, but will be there for me when I really truly need them. And that's infinitely of more value than all the HR department nice words the world could offer.
Yeah, everybody wins. Everyone gets a medal. That is to real respect as kitsch is to real beauty. Mm-hmm. it's cloying, it's fake, and it doesn't really satisfy you unless you're just sort of a superficial person with sort of no moral taste.
Mm-hmm.
So let's wrap this up. We've been going for about an hour. I've really enjoyed this. Are there any sort of last things you want to say about the book? I mean, a few like little lines that you would like to use to sum up your major message points. Like, what's the relationship for you between love and hate?
I think you can't have genuine love without the latent possibility for hatred. And I think it's something that everyone sort of intuitively gets, but that they're afraid of the condemnation of other people. But if they realize that these other people who would condemn them are afraid themselves and are operating on fear, and that they have no obligation to these people, then it becomes a lot easier to become genuine in your love for the things that are worth elevating and are worth valuing, and for yourself as well, and your people. And it becomes a lot easier to be unashamed in that. And you feel a lot freer when you realize the fear behind everyone else's potential condemnation of your own love. I don't know how else to summarize it.
Well, I think that's pretty good. So,
excellent.
Yeah. So, well, I want to recommend this book. I think it's, how to put it? Eric Hoffer was famous because he was a longshoreman and a kind of sociologist slash philosopher. And Chris Robertson is going to be famous as the truck driver, sociologist, moralist, philosopher, whose first book, just the first of many, is In Defense of Hatred. So, Chris, thanks for having this conversation, and I hope we'll have others in the future.
Thank you so much.